You are listening to Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, with your host, Randy Sutton. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. On this show, we talk about all things law enforcement, and there's always plenty to talk about. So let's take a walk into the briefing room where I'm going to give you my view from the blue. Why does it seem that every time there is something crazy involving law enforcement in the news, it has the word California in it? This week is no different. There's a bad movement afoot in California right now to produce a bill that is absolutely what I call a cop killer bill. The powers that be in the insane world of California politics are doing their very, very best to undermine law enforcement at every possible area. And what they're doing now is not only shocking, but it is a steamroller, and it will affect the lives of every single police officer in California and make those lives even more at risk. Here's the headline, and I've been following this. I think I may have mentioned it a couple times while this bill was being proposed. But this is the headline that came up yesterday, and it's really frightening. California law enforcement loses round in legislative fight. California law enforcement has been trying to fend off tighter restrictions on the use of force. This is Assembly Bill 392, and it has been pushed by, quote, activists, unquote. So you know what that means. This is absolutely entirely one-sided bill. It meant to make it easier to prosecute police officers even for justifiable shootings. Now, if that sounds crazy to you, how do you even get there? How do lawmakers get to the point where they are so in such deep hatred of law enforcement that they're willing to risk their lives even more? Now, we all know that policing is a dangerous, dangerous job, and very often the use of force has to take place so very quickly. The officer has to gauge the use of force that's being used against him, the threat that is before him or her, and then decide to act appropriately. What is the appropriate action? Now, for years, the standard has been what's called the reasonable officer standard. That is, would a reasonable officer, given the same set of circumstances, have made the same decision to use deadly force? This was a major change by a Supreme Court in Tennessee versus Garner and some other court decisions. The Supreme Court, here's the way it used to be, folks. I mean, in the not too distant past, simply running away from the police, the law enforcement could use deadly force and kill that individual. That changed under Tennessee versus Garner, and the fleeing felon rule changed as far as now a police officer or law enforcement officer can't simply open fire on a fleeing felon. They have to be able to articulate why that individual is a threat to other people and a deadly threat or serious bodily injury. So the law changed dramatically when the court decided that the fleeing felon rule had to be altered. And so what came as a result of that was the reasonable officer provision. And that is when observing how police officers act when they use deadly force, did the threat that they perceived, would a reasonable officer have acted in the same way? Now, this is reasonable because let's face it, you know, many of these deadly force decisions take place within seconds. Now, what these legislators and activists and politicians in California are trying to do is remove that reasonable officer, that reasonableness, away from the law. And now they are trying to put in the word necessary. Now, that may not sound like such a big deal, but here's where they're going to get you. And they really are. This is targeted against law enforcement officers. Because what this new law says is that after the smoke has cleared, was it necessary to use deadly force? Now, why does that sound okay and it's really not? Here's how. Suppose the officer sees a gun in an individual's hand, they point it at him, he opens fire, he kills the suspect. End of story, right? Well, wrong. Suppose that gun is not loaded. Now, the officer has no way to know that. Suppose that gun is a replica, and the officer has no way to know that. Suppose it doesn't have a firing pin. The officer has no way to know that. They only know that they perceive the threat, and a reasonable person would say, okay, that guy's pointing a gun at me. I'm in deadly danger here. I'm going to use deadly force. Well, now, they can, under this proposed law, they can now charge that officer with murder because the gun wasn't real. Now, this is the reality. This is what this new law proposes. That and it doesn't say in there who's going to make the determination that it was necessary or not. It is absolutely a one-sided anti-law enforcement life bill. This is the cop killer bill, and it's being steamrolled through as far as the lawmakers go. So now what law enforcement tried to do, and this was, once again, law enforcement is reasonable. These activists and these political individuals who are so anti-law enforcement, they really aren't reasonable. That what the law enforcement profession put forth was a different kind of bill that codified the reasonable officer standard, but also put in a lot of training in de-escalation and other such politically correct training. But this wasn't enough. That for this was gutted by that reasonable change was gutted by the agenda-driven politicians in California, and the last man standing is this horrendous, horrendous bill, Assembly Bill 392, and of course, you know what they're doing is they're making it sound like this is the progressive. This will be the toughest bill in the United States. Well, sure it will, because it came out of California. It's designed to be anti-law enforcement. Now, if you're a cop and you now realize that you use deadly force and you're going to be now open to criminal charges up to and including murder, why the hell would you even get out of your car? So not only is this going to be a dangerous situation for the police, but of course it's going to be, once again, it's going to affect the citizens of California. Now here's kind of the irony here. One of the main sponsors of this horrendous bill is an assemblywoman named Shirley Weber. Shirley Weber is about as activist as they get, clearly anti-law enforcement. Well, she also was the sponsor of the proposition bill that passed that was absolutely sold a bill of goods to the voters of California as a public safety bill. But what it really did was it decriminalized almost everything. It was this bill, Proposition 47, which now, this was in 2014. It has now been given the dubious honor of the Golden Fleece Award as absolutely being sold to the California voters as one thing, when in fact it was something else entirely. And this was also brought to you by Shirley Weber. So the fact that she keeps on getting voted in after literally lying to the voters of California about this Proposition 47. Now, what did Proposition 47 actually do? It decriminalized theft. It decriminalized forgery, fraud, and basically made crimes that were felony crimes into either misdemeanors or no crimes at all. And now, of course, in political speak, they're looking at the crime statistics, and they're saying, you see, crime went down because they don't have as many indexed crimes. Well, no, it's not. It's just that it's not a crime anymore. And besides that, the people of California aren't even bothering to call the police because they know that their hands are tied, that they are ineffective given the latitude that these criminals have that can literally do their crimes with impunity. And this is taking place in California. I am seriously concerned about this bill that is now being proposed. You layer that on top of Proposition 47, and you have a recipe for disaster when it comes down to the safety of these men and women who are serving in law enforcement in the state of California. This is something that if you are a listener and you live in California, I urge you to contact your assembly people and tell them what you think about this cop killer bill. It's only going to be public pressure that can stop this now. And I'm very concerned that the loudmouth activists are running the California Assembly, and it no longer has anything to do with common sense or with legitimate bills that assist the public safety. This is about making a progressive campaign of anti-law enforcement rhetoric. That's all this is. And it's going to cost cops lives. There's absolutely no doubt about it. Now, California isn't the only place where craziness is going on. New Jersey, my old home state where I was a police officer. Boy, I'm wrong. It's New York. New York is now trying to pass a bill. Let me read the headline and sit down for this one. New York lawmakers consider allowing all inmates to ask for, quote, elder parole, unquote, at age 55. Yeah, you heard it right. You can be convicted of murder, get life in, because they, of course, they don't have a death penalty anymore. You can get life in prison without parole, and you can be 50 years old. In 5 years, you're eligible for parole under this goofy, ridiculous proposed legislation. This is all part of the agenda that was begun under the Obama administration. This is the agenda of entitling criminals. We're creating an entire new class of citizen, the criminally entitled. I think I'm going to write an entire article about that because that's exactly what we're doing. So, in essence, those political individuals that subscribe to the Obama/Holder philosophies that were still being saddled with are vehemently against incarceration. They simply do not believe that people should go to prison, that there should be any accountability, should be any criminal penalties for people committing crimes. They want to do everything possible to keep people out of prison. So they put forth legislation like this, elder parole. Good God, who came up with this? Well, I can tell you who came up with it, but Senator Brad Hoyleman. What a goofball this guy is. Well, I really hope that cooler heads and more reasonable people that are in the New York State Legislature slap this guy down, because this is got to be one of the dumbest ideas I've ever heard. And it just shows you that New York and California seem to have a competition for who can be goofier when it comes down to creating new laws. Well, we're about running out of time, and I know we got to get into the interview room where you're going to get to hear my guest today here on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I want to tell you guys about a pretty amazing product. It's called Arrest My Vest Spray. And really what it's designed to do is when you are wearing a ballistic vest, you know, it gets sweaty, it gets hot, it gets drenched, from working out in the street. And sometimes it doesn't smell all that well. And this is an amazing product that takes that odor away. And you don't even have to use it just for the vest. It takes pet odors away. It's great for your vest. It's great for your dog bed. Everything else that you need a deodorizer for. This stuff is amazing. Check it out. It's at stinkyvest.com. Go to stinkyvest.com and check out Arrest My Vest Spray and arrest the odors. I want to tell you about a company called Law Enforcement Specialists. If you are an active duty law enforcement officer and you're looking to work extra jobs like security and traffic jobs, these are the people you need to go through. We all know that working extra jobs is what gives us the extras, gives us that little extra payment that we need, or perhaps gives us the opportunity to take our families out to dinner a little more often. And the only way to do it is to be working extra jobs. So what they do is they're all over America. I think they're in everything but a couple of states. And they work with your organization, your administration, and find off-duty jobs to work. You got to check them out. Go to offdutypoliceofficers.com. That's offdutypoliceofficers.com. And register with them, contact them. Now, if you have security needs, this is the company you want to go through as well. If you are looking for both security or traffic jobs, if you have a company that requires that, you want to contact these folks as well. They're good people. They're based in Arizona, but they have police officers and services all over the country. Go to offdutypoliceofficers.com.
The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world, to unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. News blogs, informative podcasts, and entertaining videos. It's AmericaOutloud.com, where the conversation never ends, with 24/7 streaming on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa. award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
With me today in the interview room of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, is a man who has an incredible history of not only law enforcement, but doing some amazing things with missions around the world, helping people who are in need of medical assistance. His name is Eric Linder. I've known Eric for many years. He is a retired Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, a police officer. He served with three different militaries. He served with the United States Air Force, he served with the Israeli Defense Force, and he served as a UN peacekeeper. And now he has created an organization called Team 5. Team 5 is made up of special operators from different militaries, all with medical backgrounds, and they do some incredible work. Eric, welcome to Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement.
Thanks for having me, Randy.
Let's go back to your earlier life, because you know no one creates an organization and gives back as much as you do without having a history of service. So let's go back. You started your service career basically very, very young. Let's talk about that for a moment, and then we'll work into what Team 5 does.
Sure. I actually started when I was in high school. I was an athlete and doing all these other things and trying to keep myself busy. And a friend of mine was volunteering on the local first aid squad. And so just one day he brought me down there to hang out. And I was like 16 years old. And he's like, "You got to check this out." So I went down there and I rode with him a few times on the ambulance and kind of had a knack for it. We would go to car accidents and we were going to heart attacks, and we're only like 16 years old. And you know, back then laws were different and times were different. And we would ride on the ambulance, and I really enjoyed it. So I ended up getting my EMT when I was in high school, and they couldn't even give it to me until I turned 18, which is like 2 years later. But they let you act like it, you know, like you could actually act in the performance of your job as an EMT when you're 16, even though you don't get the actual certification until you're 18. And I kind of had a knack for it. The blood didn't bother me. They gave me this pager. The high school let me leave when I was in my senior year. If a call went off, you know, they gave me a blue light to put on my car. It's crazy.
You were in heaven
today. Yeah, I was loving it. So I'm like, okay, what am I going to do with my life? And then I decided, you know what, I'm going to go in the service. I always wanted to go in the service, and originally wanted to go in the Marines, and my dad's a prior Vietnam guy, and he's like, "Yeah, you're not doing that." And I wasn't 18 yet, so I couldn't sign the form. So we negotiated to go into the Air Force, and went there, and I did rescue in the Air Force for 4 years, and I was running the rescue crew there, and got stationed around the world and continued my education into paramedic medicine and started looking at PA programs and other stuff. And when I got out of the service, I kind of got dumped off here after Desert Storm in Las Vegas. And I actually did a ride along with some cops I met at a bar. And they're like, "Hey, why don't you come tomorrow and do a ride along?" And I'm like, "All right." And so I did a ride along and I really got interested in with Metro, and so I joined Metro, but I kept my medicine going, and I transferred my medical stuff from New Jersey to here. And we, back then, you know, our SWAT teams and our tactical teams and narcotics and all these guys, we were never running any medics, and people were getting hurt. And at the time, Keller was in charge over there of the gang unit, and I was in a gang unit, and we were doing all these raids all the time, and guys were getting hurt. And I'm like, "Hey, there's this class that the NTOA is going to put on," and it was their first tactical medical class that they've ever done.
The NTOA is the National Tactical Officers Association, just for the listeners.
Yeah, Yeah. And so I asked Keller, I'm like, hey, can I go to this? And he's like, yeah, that would be great. Go ahead. So I go to the class, get certified, come back. And we started running all these different things going on with us on Metro before they handed it over to Search and Rescue, because later on, all the tactical medicine went to Search and Rescue. And I did that, and I, again, started working in the hospitals. I was working at UMC and keeping my credits up and my hours up. And then, like I told you before, I happened to go to this conference in Florida, and it's on counterterrorism. And I went there, and I got introduced to a guy who's actually a three-star general. His name is Alec Rond. He was in the Raid of Entebbe. He started what we would consider our Delta Force here, which is called Sirte Mikal in the military there. And he's really well-recognized guy. And he was, at the time, he was a three-star general in charge of the police. And I met him, and we went to dinner, and we started talking. And he's like, look, we are building something similar to what you guys do over there with tactical medicine within our police organizations. Why don't you come out and train with us for a month? And so after getting permission from Metro and going out there for a month, which was amazing, because they treat you really well, and it was hard. There's no doubt about it. You have to keep up with these guys. And I was fortunate enough to be young enough, still in really good shape. And I came back to Metro, and I was doing my normal duty. And I was, at the time that I went over and did this, I was now in, I was still in the gang unit. And so I was doing that. And so about a month later, they call me up and they start this whole recruiting process of, hey, what do you think about moving to Israel? And I'm just like, hey, man, I got 10 years on at this point. I'm staying here. I'm not going to leave. And then they went through the police department. They're like, hey, you need to let Eric come over here and do what they call a fellowship, is the word that they used. And I went over there and I got more training, served in the units, served in a lot of good units over there during the Lebanon War, a lot of hands-on, doing pararescue. I could do between 1 to 5 missions a day. So, you know, you're flying in with a Black Hawk and you're going behind enemy lines and you're saving the lives of the soldiers as well as the South Lebanese, because they were on our side and we were helping them out. And I come back to the States afterwards after 2 years and continue my education.
So hold on just 1 second. So you actually did 2 years of military service in the Israeli Defense Force.
Yeah, I was assigned to the pararescue unit and I was a sergeant major. Since I was a sergeant in the United States Air Force, they brought me over as a sergeant over there, and then I earned the rank of sergeant major. I ended up doing 2 years full-time, and then I did almost 11 years as a reservist and retired as a sergeant major.
Amazing. Amazing. Okay. So after 2 years of service where you saw all kinds of action, did some incredible medical stuff. That was your assignment over there. And then you came back to the States and back to the police department.
Yeah, and I started teaching for Metro. I was talking about a lot about counterterrorism, about suicide bombings. I was teaching the academy. I was teaching in in-service training. And then they loaned me out to the FBI for a little while, and I built a course for them on what we would say back then, and now it's not considered good terms, but profiling, suicide bombers. That was the name of the course. And so I did that. And 9/11 hit. And when 9/11 hit, the federal government came to me because they had just started Department of Homeland Security and said, hey, we would like you to be a part of our new unit that we're doing, which is covert. And I'm like, I don't know. At this point now, I had like 12 years on Metro. And I'm like, I'm pretty comfortable here. And they said, well, what do you make? And I told them. And they said, well, we'll double it. And I said, when do I leave? they said, we're going to put you through FLETC, which is the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. You'll be a special agent. You know, you're going to be getting trained by guys from Dev Group and Delta, and you're going to get some really great training. And all you're going to do is fly around and try to find these Al-Qaeda guys. And I said, yeah, it sounds like fun. And so I'm always up for the adventure. And I actually started the tactical medical program for that as well, because here we are chasing bad guys. It's a brand new unit. It's a brand new, Homeland Security was, just starting off. And I said, we don't have anything medical. And they're like, no. I'm like, well, we need to do that. So we started a program here. I was based in Vegas with tactical medicine. And Hecht actually, Dr. Hecht actually ran it for us. And he later became Metro's doctor for tactical medicine. And we built that here. And after about 2.5 years flying around and, being that guy that's in that glass jar and you can't do nothing unless it's an emergency and they break it, gets old after a while. You get all that training and you're ready to do something, but they're scared to use you because then you're out of the box at that point. So, and that happens to a lot of really good units. They train and then they're scared to utilize you.
Sure.
And I got bored. So I said, I put my feelers out and I said, what's the next adventure for me? And the UN said, hey, we got this thing in Kosovo. There was ethical cleansing going on. Do you want to go out there and run this detail to find bad guys that did all this ethical cleansing and mass graves? And I'm like, sure. So I jumped over there and I was running the ethical cleansing for about 2 months. And then they asked me, hey, can you step up and be the director of the UN for Kosovo for a few months until we can find somebody? Because the person that was supposed to do it from the United States backed out at the last minute. And I said, well, that's kind of a big job. I mean, it's 7,500 international peacekeepers, 500 investigators just handling ethical cleansing.
Stay by. You mean ethnic cleansing?
Ethnic cleansing.
Not ethical cleansing.
That's true. Ethnic cleansing. So I said, sure. So I stepped in for 2 months, and then 2 months ended up turning into a little bit over a year. And
so you were in charge of 7,500 UN personnel that was basically trying to stop ethnic cleansing and the mass murder that was taking place in Kosovo.
Yeah, it was crazy. We would have like 2 or 3 assassinations a week. People would be throwing satchel bombs over the UN walls. There was a lot of organized crime that was going on because at this point, they didn't have a police force, Kosovo of its own, because the country had fallen. So everybody was just running around doing whatever they wanted to. And the peacekeepers came in to try and organize and then eventually train the local law enforcement and then give it back to them, which they did years later. And now Kosovo is an actual state, where before it wasn't a state when I was there.
Wow, you're part of living history, law enforcement history from around the world. So what was so you came back from the UN after a couple of years, then what?
Well, when I was working for the UN, my kids were young and they're here in the States, and I was flying back and seeing them like every 6 months. And a friend of mine was working for a Fortune 500 company and said, hey, look, we're looking for somebody that can run health and safety and security for the company, and we know that you have the medical background and you have the security and this and that. Would you be something you'd be interested in? And I was like, what's the pay, which we always have. And the pay was there, and I said, sure. So I came back, and I've been with the company for 12 years now. And while I was here, one of the agreements I had is I wanted to finish my medical degree because I've always been really close. So they were like, no problem. So they invested in me. And over a 2-year period or so, part-time, I finished my medical degree. I ended up pushing that a little bit farther, and I got a fellow. And while I was doing all this, part of the part of the schoolwork was that you had to go and do residency abroad. So I did my residency in Belize. And when I was there, I was attaching myself to all of these different nonprofit groups that are basically missionaries that are going out, and they would do medical clinics and dental clinics, but there was always a strings attached to it. So they would say, hey, we'll do this medical, but you know, this is our religion, or we have to build a church here, or we have to build a schoolhouse here. So it always had something that was religious or political affiliated to it. And instead of just going to the indigenous and letting them run their lives and you know, the way that they wanted to run it, they were kind of forcing things down their throat. So a little bit of a quid pro quo. And it always bothered me. I'm like, why can't you just go and do the right thing? Why do they have to have strings attached? It doesn't make sense to me. So that was going on for a few years. And I went to Africa, and I was in Guatemala, and I was in all these different places attaching myself to other missions that did great work. But again, there was always some sort of string attached to it. Like, they just didn't go out there and just do the right thing. And my friends finally were tired of listening to me talk about it and said, put up or shut up. So I said, all right, well, let's give it a shot. So I went out to Guatemala from Belize on a boat. And that's like a long trip. And I took it across the ocean without any plan with two other doctors. And I said, let's just find some Mayan chief somewhere and see if we can't sell this to him. So we ended up, after a couple of days talking with everybody, we venture all the way out in the middle of the jungle in Guatemala, and we meet this chief near the Isabel region. And I said, look, we just want to come out and help you and then run these medical missions. And they couldn't fathom it. They couldn't understand. They're like, well, why would you want to do that? What do you want from us? And I'm like, I don't want anything from you. I just, what, you know, I come from a good country. I have a nice house. I have this and this. I want to give back. I enjoy being out here. I enjoy, you know, the wilderness, and I enjoy the challenge. And so after talking with him for a while, he's like, okay, in 1 year, let's do a thing where you come back and you do it here. And I said, okay, I'll see you in 1 year. And I said, I got to raise money anyways. I didn't have a 501c yet. I had a lot of homework to do. So I came back to the States and applied for my 501, and I started building the foundation, and I started getting all the licensing and funding. And a year to the day we returned, we had kept conversation, returned to them with our first mission. And it was a very successful mission. And we decided that what we wanted to do to differ ourselves from other foundations is that we wanted to make a complete mission, which was, we'll go to a place that has never been serviced before. We're going to teach them medicine. So all their local health care providers and witch doctors and everything else, we wanted to give them some education. So we asked them, what did they want to learn? And so we put a program together, which was difficult because they don't even speak Spanish. They speak Quechua, which is their own language. So I had to then get interpreters and send it to them in English. Then they translate it to Spanish so that the other translators can then translate it into Quechua. And then after I did all this, I found out that these people don't even read Quechua because they're all the indigenous. So I had to put everything into pictures. So it was like one thing after another. It was a learning curve. So we go out there, we teach them, we have them shadow us for a week. Every day we're going to a different location by boat that has never been serviced before. And it was a blast. And it was very welcoming. They're very happy to see us. We donated all of the medicine at the end. And our objective was, is when we leave, we're most likely never going to come back because we want to trailblaze. So we want that location to be sustained on their own, because we never know who's going to come behind us. So we give them a skill set, we're treating them, they're shadowing us, and at the end we give them the equipment and the medicines that they needed so that they can be successful. And then that just turned into more and more, because in the beginning we were just doing like a medical clinic. And then they said, we really need dental. So then we added a dentist. And then they said, well, we have a lot of pregnant women. So then I got an ultrasound machine, and I went to school for ultrasound. And then they said, oh, we have all these cleft palates, and we added surgeons. So now the team is you know, very diverse, but we stayed small. And there's only five medical members that deploy at a time, because you can only put so many people in a boat, you can only put so many people on a bus, you can only put so many people in a helicopter, and it keeps the costs down so that we can do more missions rather than bring in a whole entourage of people. So basically in a mission you have a plastic surgeon, an oral surgeon, two PAs or special forces equivalent, and then a pediatric intensive care nurse. And then we all work together, and it becomes very successful.
That just the concept alone of putting this together had to be a logistical nightmare. And then each of these missions where you are traveling to literally to some of the remotest areas on Earth to provide the medical services. I mean, who does all that planning? I mean, that's a full-time job in and of itself.
Yeah, I do over 90% of it. And when people come on a mission, I always tell them, you know, pack a good attitude, because nothing's going to go right. And it never does. So everything's always dynamic. I mean, we showed up to go to Peru a few years back, and I had met with the general. I had advanced the trip, went out there. They flew me in a C-130 Mi-17 Russian helicopter. I had to take three hops. I make it to the general and the support operating base, a FOB, that no one's ever been to before as a civilian. And I make an agreement with him to come out there to do these medical missions. And in return, I'll train his pararescue guys in combat medicine for 3 days. And I'll bring a whole team of instructors out. If you bring me to the villages that I want to go to that have never been serviced before, which just happens to be in the narcotics human trafficking region and where the Shining Path is very active. And so he says, yes. Well, 2 months later, I return with the trip. We return with the team, and we arrive we're at the military airlift to find out that the night before, that general got arrested for drug trafficking. So now I don't have a general.
Talk about everything going wrong.
Everything went wrong. So we were like, why are we sitting here for like 6 hours? Like, so finally I got the interpreter and I started talking to him, and I started getting a little loud, and I said, no, I want to talk to somebody. And I got on the phone with this colonel, and he said, all right, this is what just happened. I said, well, how are we solving this? This is a very expensive mission. I said, and we're here and we have all the supplies. He says, we're working on a new general right now. And I said, okay. An hour later, the helo shows up. We get up and we go, we land over there. Takes like three hops to get there, and we're up and over the Andes, and I meet the new general. I'm like, what is going on? He's like, yeah, this is what happens. This is Peru. So then now I have this new general. I have to go through everything all over again. And they were kind of skeptical of us because they had in other regions medical teams come in and botch surgeries. And so what we did was I said, why don't we grab some of these botched surgeries and we'll fix them for you, because we had a plastic guy with us. And we went in there and we did a couple surgeries and they were blown away. And then they opened the door for us and they said, whatever you guys want. And it was a very, very, very successful mission. And just 2 days ago, we received another permit to go back to that same location. And we're the only ones ever to have been there. And now we're going to go back 3 years later to the same location as for the operating base, because it's way out there in the jungles. And then they're researching five new villages for us that have never been serviced. And
First of all, Eric, I got to say that I'm a little jealous, quite honestly. you're an adventurer, literally creating your own path in these areas of the world that no one's ever really even explored in some cases, and you're doing so while you are literally putting your life and the lives of your team on the line, going into these hot areas where guerrillas actually, you know, control some of the territory. And that's actually one of my questions. you're in a hostile zone in some of these cases. Have you ever come under attack or had basically to fight your way out of certain places?
When we were in Peru, we were disrupting the narcotics and human trafficking so much that the terrorist group put $1 million bounty on me. And so the Peruvian army then gave us 35 commandos for protection. And we didn't tell the team what was going on, you know, with all this. And what we didn't know was their equivalent to would be like our CIA or whatever, went and found the commander's daughter. Now, she had a botched cleft palate years and years ago from another doctor.
You mean the commander of the
terrorist group?
Terrorist group. Okay.
Yeah. So they went and found her, took her, flew her to our FOB. Keith and I end up doing this 3-hour surgery, reconstructing, doing a rhino and a cleft palate, and, you know, 3 hours in surgery, not knowing who she was. And we did an amazing job on the surgery. We did 13 surgeries in 3 days, Keith and I, not including our normal clinical stuff that we do. And when we finished the surgery, they told us who she was. They took pictures and sent it to the commander of the terrorist group. And then he put out a message to all of his people that we were hands off, and if anybody touches us, they would answer to him.
That was a brilliant idea on somebody's part.
Yeah, it was. And we didn't know about it for days later, about everything that was going on. But, and it also helped them with the relationship with the terrorist group and allowing us to go into these indigenous areas and not having to worry so much about the guerrillas and the terrorists coming after us. And when they went out, the 35 commandos, at one point they were clearing areas for us before we went out there, like a day or so ahead of us. And then when we flew out there, we went out there with the general, and they were moving it, and they actually found 100 pounds of ANFO and C4 that was hidden. Yeah. And so they ended up getting that. That was a good find for the Peruvian army. And when we started meeting with the indigenous elders, they never wanted the military in there because they don't trust them. But we were able to help bridge relationships with them because I said, look, let's go in there. We'll run a medical clinic, a dental clinic for half a day. You guys bring your commandos, because they're going to be with us anyways, inside the clinic. We had a whole bunch of solar lights that were donated to us to donate to other people. So I said, why don't you have your guys donate the solar lights? Why don't you guys have your guys donate the sunglasses that were donated? Instead of us doing it as a foundation, have you guys do it as soldiers and see if that helps out. And it really did. You can see that everybody let their guard down. The indigenous were like, oh, okay, the soldiers aren't so bad. And they're giving us things and they're helping us. And we were deworming the whole village because it's one of the biggest problems is worms. And you have to do it 1 week, and then a week later you have to hit them again. So we then taught the medical soldiers that were there, that were in our class, how to give them and how to dose the patients. And a week later, after we left, they sent another helicopter over there, and they did the second round of deworming, and again building those relationships between the military and the indigenous.
Amazing.
So we're helping on a lot of levels.
I can see that. So we're running out of time, Eric. How do people learn more about you and donate to your cause? Because it's a tremendous, tremendous cause, Team 5. How do they find you?
So we're on a lot of different social network platforms, but we have our own website, which is www.team-5.org. And then All About Social Network is team, the number 5 foundation, whether it's Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, it's all the same. And if you go on, if you go online and just punch in Team 5 Foundation, we pop up number 1. And when people do donate, the money goes directly to the missions. We don't play around with the donations. We're not that. We're a platinum rated veteran nonprofit 501c3.
That should be very give a lot of comfort to the donors, knowing that you basically have no administrative costs. Everything goes into the mission, and you guys are doing an amazing job, Eric. Thanks so much for taking the time to be on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, sharing your story and talking about the amazing work that you and your team are doing.
Thanks for having me. And for all the listeners, if you're a veteran and you got a medical background and you want to participate, if you go to our website, there's actually a place that you can apply.
Good to know.
Love to have you.
Great, great. Thanks again, Eric.
Thank you.
End of Watch with Randy Sutton.
Each week on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we have the unfortunate duty to report on the men and women of the profession who have given their lives in the line of duty and pay respects to those men and women. Unfortunately, I have two names to read today. The first is Conservation Officer Eugene Nguyen Jr. of the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources Enforcement Division in Minnesota. Conservation Officer Eugene Nguyen drowned in Cross Lake after being thrown from a boat at approximately 7:45 p.m. He and a Pine County Sheriff's deputy were responding to a report of a possible body floating in the lake. They had just left the boat launch when they were both thrown out of the boat into the frigid waters. Deputies on the shore attempted to reach them in a rowboat, but Officer Nguyen slipped below the surface and did not resurface. They were able to rescue the deputy, who was treated at a local hospital. Officer Nguyen had served with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources for 18 years. He is survived by his wife and 2 children. Conservation Officer Eugene Nguyen Jr., Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, End of Watch, Friday, April 19th, 2019. The second is Police Officer Kyle Olinger of the Montgomery County Police Department in Maryland. Police Officer Kyle Olinger succumbed to complications of a gunshot wound sustained on August 13th, 2003, while making a traffic stop at the intersection of 2nd Avenue and Spring Street in Silver Spring. He was speaking to one of the occupants when he observed one of the passengers attempting to conceal a handgun under the seat. He ordered the man to drop the weapon before a struggle ensued. The man shot Officer Olinger in the neck, injuring his spinal column. The subject and 3 other occupants of the vehicle fled the scene in a car, but were all apprehended a short time later. The man who shot him was convicted of attempted murder and subsequently sentenced to life in prison. Officer Olinger remained paralyzed below his chest. He passed away from complications of his wound on April 18, 2019. Officer Olinger served the Montgomery County Police Department for 2 years and had previously served with the Reading Police Department for 6 years. He is survived by his wife and 2 sons. Police Officer Kyle Olinger, Montgomery County Police Department, End of Watch, Thursday, April 18th, 2019. May these officers rest in peace. Well, that about wraps it up for me. I appreciate you taking the time to listen to Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, here on the America Out Loud Network. Here we try not just to entertain, but to bring the truth about the American law enforcement officer to you. Look me up on Facebook under The Voice of American Law Enforcement. If you are a Twitterer, join me on Twitter at LT Randy Sutton. And as always, support our injured and disabled law enforcement officers. Go to The Wounded Blue on Facebook. Like us, follow us, support us. Go to thewoundedblue.org. Go to thewoundedblue.org and see how we can help the American law enforcement officer, if you are one of them, and how you can help support this organization. Thanks again. We'll see you next week right here on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement.
I'm Dr. Ron Martinelli.
And I'm Linda Martinelli.
As former law enforcement officers, we know that your life and the lives of those you love and work with can change in an instant when you encounter an active shooter.
Unfortunately, in today's world of uncertainty, encountering an armed active shooter can have deadly consequences. That's why the key to survival is training and preparedness.
And that's why we want to invite our listeners to seriously consider taking our Response to Active Shooter training course.
Violence can happen to you anytime and anywhere and when you least expect it. Having a response and survival plan and engaging it can be the difference between life and death for you or a family member.
Our Response to Active Shooter courses are customized for the corporate, school, church, restaurant, and small business environment at a reasonable budget that fits your needs.
So don't put this life-saving training off because you don't think it will ever happen to you. We call those people victims.
Our Response to Active Shooter instructors are all nationally renowned tactical law enforcement experts who will guide you through the life-saving protocols you'll need to survive an active shooter event.
So be a victor, not a victim. Go to ResponseToActiveShooter.com to learn more today.
Remember, that's all one word, ResponseToActiveShooter.com, and be safe out there.